Thanks. Aww. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's so nice. I really wanted to start off with just a huge thank you to everyone for having me out this weekend to spend some time at the church and to get to cover these services. Last night, I got to do the first service, and then I got to spend an evening with the youth group. And you have just such a wonderful community. And I got to meet some of the strongest, most inspiring, and resilient people that I probably ever met last night, and just had some of the best conversation. I was wishing I had like another 5 hours just to talk to everybody afterward. And so, it just means a lot. I grew up in San Jose, California, and moved to a town of 800 to Buckland, Kansas, when I was 13 years old. So I was born and raised in San Jose. So that was kind of a culture shock. I was a pretty angry kid for a little while, but then I grew to love it, obviously. But so it always means a lot when I get to come close to home. And my older sister still lives here, and she's coming to the next service, and I get to go back to San Jose with her and spend a couple days just catching up with her too. So I just wanted to start off with just a huge thank you to everybody there. Before I jump into everything. And into my story, I guess I really wanted to start with an acknowledgement. And I fully know that everything I went through, my recovery took me the better part of about 3 years and 50 surgeries. And throughout that time, you know, I learned some really tough lessons, but every single thing that I went through throughout that time, the pain and the loss of a loved one and the depression and the anxiety and the insecurity and sleeplessness and bad dreams, I know that we all go through these things, you know, and there's no gauge for what's better or worse when you're struggling with something because it just consumes you, you know, it consumes your heart and mind and soul. So there's no comparing better and worse, or what's better or worse, because when you're in it, it just really takes you over, you know. And I have to give, obviously, all the glory to God for helping me through all of this, because I know so often in our lives when we pray to God, we expect him to be like a genie, and poof, things should appear. And if they don't appear, then he must not be listening, or he must not be paying attention. But I don't think that's how he works at all. And at least in my life, the way he seemed to work with me was that I would pray for help, and he would send me opportunity, and opportunity would come in the form of people. And it was up to me to recognize and capitalize on these people coming in and out of my lives. And I didn't see it for a long time because I was pouting. I was playing the victim card, and I was looking at the ground. But once I picked my eyes up and I started watching for these opportunities, it defied coincidence just how often just that right person came into my life at just the right time to do or say just the right thing just to get me to that next day. And sometimes it could be something as simple as just a little kid saying something that I needed to hear, you know. But throughout that, he carried me. And so, but for the longest time, I was so inside myself, and I was playing that victim card. And I've grown to really not love the word victim at all. And I know you hear burn victim a lot. We always prefer burn survivor, but victim in any sense, I just can't stand it, because I feel like as long as we have a pulse in our minds, we can always fight back, you know, against even the toughest circumstances. And I feel like Paige had to be a victim because she wasn't given the opportunity to come back. And I was given that opportunity. I very nearly squandered it, you know. And I think at any point in our lives, every person in this room, we can all come up with 10 different reasons that we are a victim to our circumstances. And we can use those things as reasons to not try or to give up or to be a jerk to somebody else. But at the end of the day, that's all they are, is excuses. Because every single other person in the room can come up with the exact same reasons, and they can do the exact same thing, you know. And so not only do I believe we don't have to be victims to our circumstances, I think it's just the opposite. I believe we can actually be masters of our circumstances and take all those difficult things that we've been through that should have beaten us, that should have taken us out, that could have destroyed us, and we can use those things to help propel ourselves forward and to help give back to others and to help the people around us too. And I cannot stand pity. Pity is a noose that we can hang ourselves with if we're not careful. And once we start to allow pity into our hearts, and especially in the form of self-pity, we start to feel sorry for ourselves. We start to convince ourselves we're alone in crowded rooms. We feel like we have it worse than everybody else. We feel like other people can be happy and we can't. And none of that is true. It's just our season. And sometimes our seasons can last a long time, you know. But everybody on this planet throughout our lives, we are going to experience dark and light seasons. And I think if we're in a good season, I think it's our obligation to help the people around us through their dark seasons. But I think where we really find ourselves, where we find our purpose, where we find our potential, where we find out who we are and what we're made of and find that momentum is if we are in our own dark season, whether it is our day-to-day stresses, which can feel like the weight of the world, or during a really tragic time. But if we're in our own dark season and we're able to get over ourselves long enough to do something for somebody else and to look out for someone else during their dark season. And sometimes the best thing you can do for someone else is to take care of yourself, because your family watching you suffer or go through something, whether it's self-inflicted or somebody else causing it, that is the worst thing in the world, watching the people you love suffer, you know? And so I think it's just so important that that we get through these seasons. And if we play that victim card, if we just say we got dealt a bad hand, and we play the victim card, and we never make our way out of that dark season, then we will never be any good to the people around us who are going to need us one day when their dark season hits. And so life for all of us is going to be a fight at times, you know, but it is such a good fight if we are paying any attention at all. So throughout the those 3 years and 50 surgeries, I learned some really difficult lessons, and then after I had a chance to process those lessons, I learned that they weren't just lessons. They're actually weapons, weapons that we all have in our internal arsenal that God gave us that we can use to fight our way out of the dark and to fight our way to that right choice and to get us to those better days. And so what I'm hoping to do today is kind of share my story and then at the end shine a light on a few of these weapons that really helped me. And they're going to be things everybody knows. I'm not a pastor. I'm a speaker for a living. I definitely do not claim to know anything anyone else doesn't. I just hope it serves as a reminder if you find yourself in one of these spots, again, whether it's those day-to-day stresses or something really tragic, that I believe we all have these things, and they can be really helpful fighting our way back to that light. So my normal presentation is quite a bit longer than what I have today. I'm usually around an hour and 15 to an hour and a half, so I'm really doing a pretty compressed version. So for that reason, I kind of have to skip through some of the stuff as far as a lot of times I'll talk about Paige and I kind of growing up and how we came to fall in love. I got to talk with the youth group about that, which was kind of cool last night. And and everything I experienced in the road, I'm going to have to I kind of let the video do that for me. And I just wanted to jump right into to when I woke up from this coma. And to me, it took me about 2 weeks when I was in this coma. And during that time, I had these really long, vivid, dark dreams. And there were bits and pieces of the last few things I'd seen in the road that themed these dreams, the darkness and fear and fire. And so when I woke up after 2 weeks, it felt like to me that it had been 2 weeks, but it didn't feel like I'd been fighting for my life in the ICU that whole time. I thought that I'd been doing all this crazy stuff in my head. So it took me a bit to grasp my reality. And I remember the day that I did, there were a lot of people in my room, and I remembered everything from the road and all of that. And the people in this room were people who I love very much. And it's weird because they looked like strangers to me. You get used to the way the people you love look at you. It's not something you consciously think about. It's just always there, and it's comfortable, and you don't notice it until it's gone. And the way everyone was looking at me was so foreign to me that it frightened me. And I think this look in their eyes was a mix of pity and fear and sadness. But as soon as I saw them looking at me like that, I knew my situation was bad before I knew what my situation was, you know? And as I looked around the room, I noticed that Paige was not standing in the room with them. And so I started asking them to go get Paige for me. And when I said that the first time, I noticed, A, they weren't answering me, and then B, nobody was scurrying off to go get Paige for me, you know? And so I got a little more frantic, like, well, why aren't you guys going? Go get her. And meanwhile, my dad was in the background, and he was rounding everybody up, and he got him out of the room and closed the door. And then he told me that Paige didn't survive, and that she had never actually made it out of that car. And I am sure for so many of us in this room, so many of us have lost somebody who we love very much. And so you all know that feeling when you first get the news, and honestly for long after. It just feels like somebody scooped out your insides, and it's a really hollow, empty feeling. And it's like that one voice that can make everything okay is that one voice that you're just never going to hear again, you know? And so obviously it hit me really hard. And right after Dad told me, the nurses made him leave the room because they were getting ready to come in and do what they call a dressing change on me. And so after he left and before they came in, I had about 5 minutes in this room to myself to process this information. And I very vividly remember these 5 minutes. The first thing I tried to do was I tried to imagine my life and my future without Paige. And I remember as hard as I tried, I couldn't do it. She had been in my life for so long, since we were so young. I never had any version or vision of my future that she wasn't in. And from there, I started to think about the world without Paige in it, and it just made no sense to me that this rock was still spinning and she wasn't on it. And then from there, I mean, you all know, when you really love somebody, whether it's a spouse or a child or whatever it may be, but when you really love someone, you know, with every part of you, you know. You do not think, you absolutely know. If you're ever in a situation like that and their life is in jeopardy, you are going to save them or you're going to die trying. And I had failed at that. And so I remember I said this prayer, and I probably said it 5 times. And what I would do is I would pray to God that he would just let me die. And this was not one of those hopeful, kind of throwing it to the wind kind of prayers. This was like, I honestly believed that God would take me. I felt like I was already so close, and I didn't see any reason for me to still be here. And so I would say this prayer, and then I would close my eyes, and I would brace for it. You know, like, here I go. And every time I opened my eyes and I was still in that room, I felt like my room got darker. And I just felt that much more beaten and broken and disappointed. And I would always consider those few minutes in that room to be the darkest moment of my life, without a doubt. One thing that is kind of funny about that moment in hindsight is that I am I'm a pretty big SpongeBob SquarePants fan, and I know it's a kid's show, but I started watching it with my niece when she was really little, and then she kind of grew up, and I was just like, I think I'm going to keep watching this. And just like, because I can turn my brain off and laugh, and watching it now reminds me of watching it with her when she was little. But my point is, my niece and my brother had put this giant SpongeBob poster up above my bed. And because I couldn't move for like 2 months, it's like the only thing I could see. And it looked like that. I remember he definitely had a Krabby Patty with him. But every single time I look back and recall the darkest moment of my life, SpongeBob SquarePants is there with me. And so I always tell people, you never know who's going to be with you in your darkest moments, you know? I do remember quite a few times when the nurses would over-medicate me and pump me full of drugs, and SpongeBob would start doing the most awesome dances across the ceiling for me. So he's doing the whip nay-nay over here, and he's dabbing over here. And so I'm sure there's more than one time where someone walked in the room and I was laying there going, go SpongeBob, go SpongeBob. When I didn't die that day, what I ended up doing was I made a promise to myself that I was going to make it to Paige's grave. When I was in the burn center, I just never had a chance to grieve the way that everyone else did. And everybody was always in my room doing something else to me, and everything was just pain. You know, every little touch just felt like a dagger, you know. And on top of that, my friends and family, they'd all been to Paige's funeral, and they were 2 weeks into their grieving process, and it's not that they weren't still sad or broken by any means, but this was like a fresh wound for me, and they didn't want to say her name around me because they were afraid of it taking me down a dark place. And now a lot of their grief had turned to hope toward trying to save my life, and I was the least of my worries. And so it was just kind of a lonely feeling. So I just decided I was going to shove all of that down as deep as I humanly could, and I would do whatever I had to do physically to get well enough to get to that cemetery. And so that's what I used to get me through a lot of tough days in the burn center and the rehab center. You can go to the next one. Those are just some of the articles from around Paige's funeral, but I was still in the coma when these came out. You can go to the next one. So I was basically burned across 50% of my body. Pretty much from the waist up was my burn, and 42% of that was third degree and had to be grafted. And they peeled the skin from the other 50% of my body to replace the skin I lost. So I was essentially just like one giant open wound. And you know, anybody who's had a bad sunburn, you know, you don't want to be touched. But this was like an extremely bad sunburn, and parts of it just took years to heal and stop bleeding. So I brought some pictures of what I look like in the burn center just to kind of give you an idea of what I was working with, and they're a little bit graphic, but I'll get through them pretty quickly here. So you can go to the next slide. So that's my face right there. This is 8 days after the crash right here. And it turns out I have a blocked sinus on one side. So they had to shove all the tubes up one nostril. And just the damage that having all those tubes up there for so long caused, I've had to have 3 surgeries on that side to get my airway opened up again. And what's tough with that picture is that is what my friends and family had to look at for a long time and try to imagine a future for that guy. Next one. That's my back. I was all third degree across my back, and that all had to be grafted. Next one. Yeah, that's my right arm and right hand and my sweet patch of chest hair right there. So I was burned third degree across all that. And what they would do is peel chunks of skin from my legs. And they can take a chunk of skin about that big. And they run it through a machine that's kind of like rolling pins with blades. And so when it comes out the other side, it's bigger. So it will cover more surface area. And for burn survivors, if we survive that initial burn, what kills us later is either infection or fevers. Because when your body doesn't have its skin, it can't regulate its temperature. So I would get these really terrible fevers the whole 2 months I was in that burn center, get up to 106, 107 degrees, and I would be convulsing, shaking, and I'd be sweating, but I would be freezing. And I felt like I was gonna die at any second, and I would have welcomed it. It just, they were miserable. So they were trying to get the skin on me, not just to heal the wound, but also to get my body temp regulated. But what happens when they take a smaller piece of skin and make it bigger is it just makes it really thin. So the skin I have on my right hand and right arm here is just a thin layer of skin, and some of that's grafted right on my knuckles. I lost some of the tissue. I can't quite straighten my hand out all the way, and so if I don't have the glove on, if I knock my knuckles on something, it can really light me up, almost like hitting bare bone against something, you know. But if I have the glove on and the sleeve on, it helps because the skin can break easily and sun's not good for it. So I'll probably have to wear it for the rest of my life, but I'm used to it. It's just kind of like a uniform I put on anymore. I get a lot of Michael Jackson jokes out there. They're not hurtful. They're just not clever, you know? So, And then the other interesting thing with grafted skin is it doesn't grow hair and it doesn't sweat. And because it doesn't sweat, if you have grafts on over 30% of your body, you're not supposed to do endurance sports, things like running or soccer, especially in the sun, because you can overheat really easily. And I have 42%, but running was really important. I'd been training for a run when this happened, and they said that's part of what saved my life. And so I've been able to find ways around that rule the last few years and been able to run 4 full marathons, but I do them in like Duluth, Minnesota, where it's like 30 degrees and foggy in June, you know? So, next one. So that's my face right there. This is almost 2 months after the crash, and this right here is what I looked like when I left the burn center and almost that entire year afterward. It took a very long time for a lot of that to heal and stop bleeding, and you can see my ear is starting to go right there. Interesting story on my right eye there. I was burning above and below my right eyelid, and it caused it to contract so that eye wouldn't close. And I say it's interesting because for me, whenever I would close my eyes, it definitely felt to me like both of my eyes closed, but apparently the people on the other side of my face said it was pretty creepy because this eye would close and then this eye would just sort of like roll back into my head. But I feel like that's their problem, not really my problem. So, next one. And that's just a picture of me and Bruno Mars, just because I feel like after all the bloodiness, it's just kind of good to see a cute little man in a cute little hat. So you can go to the next one. But it kind of gives you an idea of what I was working with. So I wound up, for time's sake again, I'm going to skip over a lot of the hospital stories and all that, but I wound up being in the burn center for right around 2 months, and then people came out for me. I had friends and family help me a lot. The guy who caused the accident did not have insurance, and my friend Luke has a band in Wichita, and they helped throw a benefit concert for me to raise $15,000 to help pay down some of my medical bills, and I just had wonderful people around me. And so from there I went to a rehab center for 3 weeks, and at the rehab center I basically had to relearn how to do everything again. I'm right-handed, but I wasn't able to use anything on my right side for over a year, and my left side also had damage, but I had some movement in it, so I just had to find new ways to be independent, how to feed myself and open a car door, and I had to relearn how to walk and how to sit up and stand up. For burn survivors, when you have a really severe burn, as your body starts to heal, it starts creating calcium so fast that if you don't move and bend your joints, you can actually grow new bones on your joints that lock them in place, and it actually happened on my elbow. I had so much damage on my right side, I wasn't able to move this in time, and I grew this new bone, and it looked like a bridge. It locked my arm totally straight, and it was wrapped around a nerve, so it was really painful, and it took until a fourth opinion before we found a doctor who would operate on it, you know, and because a lot of times doctors don't want to touch it, because even if they get it out, it can regrow really quickly, but they were worried because I'd been in this coma that might have started to already form on my hips and knees and ankles, and so they warned me that I may not walk the same or without pain again for the rest of my life because of this calcification, or heterotopic ossification is what they call it. But they told me if I got up and moved, you can break that stuff up before it has a chance to form. And so that's kind of a lot of what I did there. And that was like all the motivation I needed. So I was able to, it never formed basically down there. So after that, they let me go home after 3 weeks at a rehab center. But even after I went home, I still had to be an outpatient for 5 hours a day, 5 days a week for the next entire year. And it took, during those 5 hours, they would do wound care, physical therapy, and occupational therapy. And it took me about a month of that year before I finally had the strength up where I could make that trip to Buckland, to the cemetery, to Paige's grave. It's about a 2-hour drive from Wichita to Buckland. And on the day we were leaving, I was so excited because this had been my goal. And I had been using this to push myself through some really awful days. And when I was using it to push myself, I always had this picture of what it was going to look like when I got to the cemetery. And in this picture, I saw myself kneeling down by Paige's grave. And sometimes I was grabbing piles of dirt and slamming them on the ground and yelling at the sky, crying, and just throwing the fit that I felt like Paige deserved from me. And the first thing I realized when I got to the cemetery is that I didn't have the strength or the balance to kneel. I was incapable of kneeling. And so I had to sit in this lawn chair. So immediately, as soon as I am seated in this lawn chair, I am frustrated because this is not how I pictured it. And I looked down at my hands and I realized I couldn't put my hands on the ground or grab anything. So I had these big splints on my hands that went all the way past my palms. And then on top of all that, I just had the surgery to fix that eye that was stuck open. So they had to go in and graft my eyelid. Then they actually had to sew my eye completely shut for 3 weeks. So my eye's sewn shut. And so I couldn't even really cry. And I was sitting there and I was thinking about how I had promised myself I was going to get here and I was going to do these things, and I couldn't even keep a promise to myself. And then I started to think about how it was my goal to get to that cemetery, and I didn't really have a goal after that. And from there, I just really started to wallow. I started thinking about how much better off my friends and family would be if I just died, and what a burden I must be on everyone. And then I started to look at my future, and I just did not see anything good in my future. I just saw more surgeries and pity and court dates and pain and sleeplessness, and I was just so tired. I can't explain how tired I was. I was tired of feeling alone in crowded rooms. I was tired of hurting all the time. I was tired of being treated differently. And so just all at once, I just made this decision that I was giving up, that I was done. And I didn't have the exact details worked out yet as to what that meant for me or when, but I just knew I couldn't keep going, and I just didn't see why I should. And while I was sitting there coming to that decision, Paige's mom pulled into the cemetery, and she didn't know I was there. She lives out that way and was bringing some flowers to the grave, and she parked and came over to the grave, and I gave her as best of a hug as I could. I still couldn't really touch people at the time because everything hurt so much, you know, and she said something like, "Hey, there's a couple rascals in the car who would really like to say hello to you." And Paige's mom and dad were divorced when she was really young, and then her mom remarried again later in life. So Paige wound up with some siblings that were quite a bit younger than she was, and two of them are named Samantha and Zachary. We call them Bubba. Samantha and Bubba, at this point, they're probably about third and fourth grade. And I absolutely, absolutely love these kids. With Paige and I being together from such a young age, I actually got to have a part in raising these kids from when they were really little. And then after that, we were the cool grown-ups who could come home and pick them up and take them to the movies and give them a bunch of Red Bull and give them back to their parents, you know? but I absolutely love these kids. And when Bev told me they were there, I was mortified, because at this point in my recovery, I had made a point to see no kids, especially kids who knew me beforehand, because I was just such a scary sight. You guys saw that last picture of what I looked like when I left the burn center. I was still bleeding from a lot of areas, and in the videos you saw I was wearing those stocking caps and everything. I had to wear those for years because I had so much damage on my head, and it bled for a really long time. They didn't want to graft it all because I wouldn't have the opportunity to get my hairline back, and so I had to shove gauze under hats for years. So I had one of those hats on. My eye was sewn completely shut. I'd lost like 65 pounds. I have a really bad scar band that runs down my neck right here. And at the time, it was so tight, it had pulled my shoulder all the way up kind of to the side of my head, and had these big splints on my hands. And I stood on my tiptoes because I got drop foot from being in the hospital. And on top of all that, I was burned on the, you know, right side of my face and the back of my head and right side. And it burned a lot of the hair off over there, but I still had some patches of hair growing in there. And for those areas to heal, they can't have hair growing in them. And so I would have to, when I'd go into those outpatient appointments, they would have to shave those areas every day. So it was one of my least favorite things that I had to go through, just because it was basically like taking a straight razor over an open wound just daily, you know. But after about 2 months of them doing that, I kind of just gave up on the left side. So I had a pretty sweet half beard thing going on, like a Gillette commercial, you know. And so when Beth told me they were there, I just knew I did not want them to see me like this. But I realized it was too late, because the car was like, you know, 20 yards away. And so I said okay, and she motioned to the car for them to get out and come over. And the door opened, and they got out and started to walk toward me. And as soon as they started to walk toward me, something hit me, and it hit me like a bolt of lightning. And it was their faces. They looked so much like Paige, and I did not remember them looking that much like Paige. And I had not seen her in so long, you know, and I hadn't seen them in so long either, but. It just struck me. It threw me back on my heels, because it was almost like she stepped out of that car. And for some reason, my next thought right after that was, I thought about, what if Bubba and Samantha were in this accident? What would I want? Not just for them, but for myself, more than anything in the world. And it would be for them to come back from this and be happy again and be strong again. And I would give or sacrifice anything to get them there. And then I thought about, what if I was gone and I was watching Paige give up the same way that I was? And I just thought about how heartbroken I would be. You know, all I would want in the world is for her to take that famous smile out and go heal hearts with it the way I know she could. And it would just destroy me if she gave up, you know. And all at once, it just kind of hit me how self-involved my line of thought was right before that. I was making this all about me, and in life, nothing's about you. And when you try to make it about you, it's just, that's the feeling you wind up with, and it's terrible. I did lose my wife, and that's terrible, but Bubba and Samantha lost a sister, and Bev lost a daughter, and so many people lost a friend, and just so many people lost Paige. And for the longest time, I was just so caught up in my own loss and my own pain that I don't think I was really there for everyone else the way that I could have been or should have been. And on top of that, they didn't lose me, and they had invested so much hope in me, and they knew it was my goal to get to that cemetery, and I had people fighting to get me there, and I was just about to flush it all away, making this all about myself. And so when I left the cemetery that day, I did have a new goal, and it's that I was going to come back from this. I was going to be strong again. I was going to be happy again. And I was never going to stop fighting, and I wasn't going to do it for myself. I was going to do it for them, for the people that I love, because I would want them to do it for me if the shoe was on the other foot. And so that's kind of what I set as my long-term goal. In between, I had a lot of short-term goals, especially in the way of surgeries and court dates. Like I said, I've had just over 50. The bulk of those were in the first 3 years, but I still have about 2 a year anymore that I'll go back for. But a lot of it's pretty standard burn guy stuff, but I want to tell you guys about one in particular really quickly before I get into my final points. So I told you I lost an ear in this accident, so I had to go to Chicago and get a really specialized surgery to get a prosthetic ear. And at first, when I was researching prosthetic ears, I wanted something that was permanent, because I didn't want something that was going to like pop off on a roller coaster or something, you know. But I guess it has to come on and off, because there's living tissue underneath that has to breathe sometimes. And so it's after I got the ear that I realized I definitely underestimated how cool it is to have an ear you can just pop on and off whenever you want, because I can like drop it in my niece's juice or put it in someone's chicken sandwich, or if my buddy's telling like a really long, boring story, I can just take it off and lay it on the table and be like, I'm listening, and then just leave. And that's happened a few times, yeah. But here, I'll show you. So that's my ear. Sometimes I like to tell myself secrets. But I always thought it would be fun to go to like a Claire's in the mall, you know, where they pierce ears, and just like that would be fun to just walk up to the counter and ask how much it would cost to get an ear pierced. And when the girl answers me, I would just be like, you know what, I think I'm going to do that. And then I would just pop it off and lay it down on the counter. And then what I would do is I would kind of shop around the area a little bit and wait for her to get up the nerve to actually poke it. And then when she poked it, I would just scream from across the store, you know, like, ah, like, you got to warn me. So that's a bucket list thing. So for time's sake, I'm going to have to skip over the some of the court stuff I normally talk about. So after, it took me about the better part of 2 years before I was able to get back to work. I was part-time at work for a long time. I worked in the arena industry for my whole career until I took on speaking full-time about 4 years ago. I was a marketing director doing all sorts of concerts, like Bruno Mars and Rob Zombie, all those kind of things. And I went back there, and once in a while, people would call and ask if I could come and speak at different events. And it's nothing I really aspired to do, and I didn't charge for it or market that I did it. But if somebody called and asked, I would do my best to take a vacation day and just go do it. And I did that for quite a few years, just on a part-time basis. And the last couple years I was at the arena, I just started to feel more and more like this is what I'm supposed to do. And a big part of that was exactly like what happened last night. It was getting to talk to people like you and getting to hear other people's stories and struggles and what other people have overcome. And I felt God telling me this for quite a long time, and I didn't want to hear it because I loved my job. I was scared to leave. And so I tried to turn it off, but he would give me sign after sign, good and bad. It was time to go. And so finally, I made the decision to leave that career and take on speaking full time. And when I did that, I had a lot of people who loved me speaking logical things to me, like a salary and career path and benefits, you know. And I was trying to argue back with a feeling, like I just feel like this is what God wants me to do, or this is what I'm supposed to do. And every time after I said that, they would say the same thing. They would say, well, I guess you have to follow your dream. And that wasn't the case either. I was in my dream job. Like I said, I got to work with artists like Bruno Mars and Rob Zombie and design posters and work with TV and radio. And I loved the music industry, and I was kind of making a name for myself out there. That was my dream job. Talking about the worst moments of my life over and over again is not a dream job for me. But my point is, on days like this where I get to come out, and nights like last night where I get to come out here and spend time with people who inspire me so much and people who I admire, I get to come back home, I get to spend time with my sister today, it does feel like a dream job to me on days like this. And I can't thank you all enough for allowing me to come out and be a part of your day and for coming to the service. And my hope with coming out and telling my story is, I just hope to use my story just to show that it's not just my story, it's sort of a version of all of our stories. And I know no two struggles are alike, but I know everything I went through, we all go through, just like I said at the beginning. So I named my presentation Fire Back, just because for all of us, at every single point in our lives, we're going to get knocked down, you know, or at multiple points in our lives. We are going to get knocked down, and a lot of times while we're down there, life is going to take a few more shots at us, and I'm sure that's already happened to all of us more than once in this room, you know. And I know we've all heard the cliched saying time and again, when life knocks you down, you have to get back up, and I think that's true, but I don't think that's enough. I think we have to get back up, and we have to fire back and take a few shots of our own, and the best way I found to do that is just to get outside of ourselves and genuinely put other people first, you know. And so often, if you're going through something difficult, somebody really well-meaning, a coach or someone else, might tell you you have to dig deep and find it inside yourself to get through this. And I think that's completely false. I dug about as deep as I could inside myself, and all I found was more darkness and despair. And it wasn't until I got outside of myself and started thinking about others, started thinking about God's plan for my life and what he wanted, and started trying to follow what Christ tried to tell us to do, that's when I was able to really find any momentum. So here really quickly at the end, for these last couple minutes, I would just like to share some of the weapons that helped me a lot to fight back, to fight my way back to the light. And like I said, I don't claim to know anything anyone else doesn't. I just hope that they serve as a reminder to everyone. If you find yourself in one of these dark seasons, whether it is those day-to-day stresses or something really tragic and difficult, that I believe we all have these weapons we can draw on to fight our way back to the light and to get through these things. So next slide. The first one is grace. And to me, in human form, I would define grace as equal parts kindness and patience and forgiveness. And I know grace can be so tough to muster if we're not having our best day, or if we're tired, or if the people around us are annoying, or if we're stressed or whatever. But if we can muster that grace to put a smile on our face and say some kind words to someone else when we least feel like it, or to people who don't deserve it, then it's the best thing that we can do, not just for them, but for ourselves. And I had so many people show me such infinite amounts of grace during my recovery, and I would not be here if not for them. People who dropped everything to help me battle my demons and to help me come back from all this. And God gives us so much grace on a daily basis and forgives so much in all of us, you know. And so just being able to pass on some of that, I think, is a huge help. Just to remember, as bad as you feel like you have it, as tough as your struggle is, that person sitting across the table from you may be in a much darker season, and something that's just as simple as a few kind words or a smile might just be enough to get them to that next day. So next one, teamwork. I I get to travel a lot for my job, and I do a lot of speaking at resilience training at military bases and Army and Air Force bases, and that is my absolute favorite place to get to talk about teamwork, because like in our world right now, it feels like we're more divided on more fronts than we ever have been, but whenever I get to go out into their world, it does not feel as much that way, and a big part of that is because those guys have a common goal, they have a common enemy, they have common core values, they put service above self, and they all come from different backgrounds and have different beliefs, but they are so much more focused on what pulls them together, and because of that, they're the most effective and famous team in the entire world, you know? And so I always feel like that's a model for what I hope the civilian world can follow one day, because right now it feels like we're getting worse and worse about not listening to each other. We're just trying to win an argument. We're not really having a conversation anymore, you know? And we're using disrespect to try to bring attention to ourselves or our cause or whatever it is that we're doing, and that's never going to work in the history of the world. Nobody who disagrees with us is going to say, well, I disagreed with you before, but now that you've disrespected me, I really want to agree with you, you know? And so so I think they're a good model for what I hope we can be. And the other thing with teamwork is I think it's important to use your team. Sometimes we feel like it's a burden to ask people for help, but it is just the opposite. It's a gift that we can give them to let them to let us help them, you know, to let them help us. And I know a lot of times we'll say our worst fear is speaking in public or spiders or heights or whatever it might be, but our worst fear, every one of us, our worst fear is watching the people that we love suffer, because it is the worst thing in the entire world. You feel so powerless, and as much as it was awful for me to be in that bed and going through this, I would take it any day over watching my mom or my sister or someone go through it, you know, and so it's so important to let people help you, because it's not fair to let them watch you suffer. So like I said, sometimes the best thing we can do for others is to take care of ourselves too. And the last thing is, I do believe we can defy our circumstances, but sometimes we need help. We need someone to put us in a position to take those swings. You know, just like the doctor who broke that bone out of my elbow, I would have never had a chance to even try to get it back if he hadn't done that. And so, it's really important to watch for those people who come in and out of our lives. Next one. Fear. Fear, I know it sounds crazy that fear is a weapon that you can use, but what I found with fear is every time I feel this emotion about something, I know that's the thing I'm supposed to do. And I use it almost like a roadmap. And I'm not talking about foolish fear, like the feeling you get before you're about to slide off of a roof into some bowling pins. I'm talking about real fear, the things we know we're supposed to do for our families, for our futures, our career, our fellow man, whatever it is. And we have these voices in our head, and our personal demons who know us better than anybody else, and they use fear. They tell us we're going to fail, or we're going to look stupid, or people are going to judge us, and they use fear to keep us from fulfilling our purpose and from finding our potential. And if we never face those demons down and take them out, they keep that thumb on us, and they maintain that power over us. And so I think it's important to use fear almost as a roadmap. If there's something you're afraid to do, I think it's important to follow that path and go there. Next one. I know I'm in overtime here, so I'll get through these pretty quickly. Next one is perspective. And whenever I talk about perspective, I like to go to the next picture, the next slide, if you could, right there. Just because I know for everybody in this room, I know we've all been through some really dark days and some really tough times. And so often when we're in the heat of those dark days and those tough times, we make promises to ourselves, and we tell ourselves when we get to the better days, we are going to appreciate them more, and we're going to love harder, and we are not going to let the little things get to us. And then so often we fight so hard. We fight so hard to get to these better days, and we make it. We get there to these better days, and then we start to dwell on all these little things that just do not matter, and they start to eat into our hearts and our minds and our souls. And that's where I think it's important to remind yourself what you promised yourself in those dark days, and just take that and compare it to whatever you're going through now, and just see if whatever you're going through now is really worth all the heartache that you're pumping into it. And I always call it the gift and burden of perspective, because I know it's a burden to gain perspective, because you have to go through something really difficult and come out the other side. But I think it's a true gift once we have it, because it makes those trivial things way more transparent, and it makes our choices so much clearer, and it points out the things that are truly important to us throughout our lives. Next one. This is the second to last one, and one of the biggest ones for me, for sure, and it's gratefulness or gratitude. For me, after my accident, I spent so much time looking over my shoulder that I was missing what was happening right in front of my face. And I remember when this lesson revealed itself to me. It was Christmas morning, the year of the accident, so it was 9 months after the crash. And I was watching my niece and nephew open their presents on the ground in front of me, and I remember feeling genuinely happy. And then I thought to myself, this is such a good moment. And my next thought was, I don't remember feeling like this for so long. I haven't seen a moment like this for so long. And then I realized immediately that that was ridiculous. I had spent like the last 9 months with my family, closer than we'd been since I was a kid. We all lived so close, and they were trying so hard for me. They were doing everything for me, and there had been so many moments like that, but I was missing them because I was so focused on who wasn't there and how I wished I looked and who I wanted to be and all those hypotheticals, the if-onlys and the I-wishes, and there are no hypotheticals in life. There's who we are at this moment, and that's where I guess I realized that for every single one of us, we are always going to have good things going on in our lives and bad things going on in our lives at every given time. And if we choose to put those bad things in front of the good things, it is going to block our view of so many great moments that are happening right in front of our faces. And it taught me the importance of being in a moment, not to look back and say that was a good moment, but to live in a moment and say, this is a good moment. Next one. This is the last one, and by far the biggest one for me, and it's letting go. For me, after my accident, I kept trying to be the Jared that I was before the accident, but I didn't look like him, and I didn't feel like him, and people didn't treat me like him, and so much of his future was wrapped around a future with Paige. So the more I kept trying to be that guy, the more beaten, broken, and disappointed I felt time and time again. And so what I ended up finding out is not only did I have to go through the grieving process of letting Paige go, but I had to go through the grieving process of letting that guy go too. And I was stuck in denial for such a long time because this is the only guy I knew how to be. I didn't know how to be anybody else. But once I came to acceptance and just came to accept that this is who I am now, this is how I look now, I'm going to have to wear the glove and the sleeve, I'm going to have some chronic pain, people are going to treat me different. But once I just came to accept everything about this person, who I am in this body right now, I was able to let him go. And I was able to take all my favorite memories and everything Paige taught him and bring him with me into this guy. And it's helped me to try to focus on being the best version of who I am now rather than the best of what's left of who I was. And I think for all of us, we all have moments in our lives that change us so much. And a lot of times we don't want to accept that it changed us as much as it did. And it can be something like a divorce or a breakup. It can be the loss of someone who's such a big part of us. It can be an injury or an illness, or sometimes it can just be aging. But so often after these things happen, we're just not the same person that we were before. And we're still trying to hold on to this version that we used to be. And the more we keep trying to be that person, the more disappointed and beaten we feel time and time again. But I truly believe if we're able to let that version of ourselves go and truly focus on being the best version of this person, then it makes every bit of difference in our lives going forward. So next one. So just to finish up, I just wanted to repeat one more time that I don't believe we ever, 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 ever have to be victims to our circumstances. I think it is just the opposite. I believe we can actually be masters of our circumstances and take all those difficult things that we've been through that should have beaten us and should have taken us out and use those things to help propel ourselves forward and find God's path for us and what he wants us to do. And I think it's so important throughout those dark seasons to watch for those opportunities, watch for those people God sends into your life to help get you through it and to help you learn about yourself and find out who you are, because I promise you they're there. It's just up to us to find them, you know? And the very last thing too, just want to remind everybody one more time about seasons, just how for all of us, life is always going to be a series of light seasons and dark seasons. And I think if we're in a good season, I do believe it's our obligation to our fellow man to help them through their dark season. But where I truly believe we find ourselves, where we find our purpose and our momentum and our potential, is if we are in our own dark season, whether it's those day-to-day stresses or something really tragic, but if we're in our own struggle and we're able to get over ourselves long enough to help someone else through their dark season. And a lot of times we struggle with purpose, and I think the purpose part of life is easy. I think Jesus showed us the way for that. I think we're all supposed to take care of one another in his name, just like the in Ephesians, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but the chapter that said, for we are all God's masterpiece, put here to do good works through Christ Jesus, basically. But I think we're supposed to take care of each other. It's the execution part that's hard sometimes, how to find out how to do that and where. So I always admire when I get to meet so many people like I have here that are doing that. And life is always, it's just always going to be a fight at times for all of us. But it's just such a good fight if we're paying any attention at all, you know. And so next slide. This is all my information right here. If you guys ever have any questions or feedback for me, or I need a speaker for anything, I speak at corporate events and hospitals and schools, pretty much anything, and I always love getting to come back this way. But I really wanted to say, oh, and then I'll be outside here. I have a little donation table, and I think I still have some t-shirts for sale out there as well if anybody would like one. But mostly, I just wanted to meet everybody, so I'll be right outside here afterward. But I wanted to say just a huge thank you one more time to everyone for coming out today. Sorry I went into overtime as well, but I still appreciate it, and I hope I get to meet so many of you before I go. So last thing, I'd just like to say a quick prayer and then let you all get on with your day. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to come out and to spend this time with everyone here, and for last night and getting to meet so many wonderful souls and inspiring hearts. And thank you, God, for coming to us during those dark season and during our times of need and showing us the way out and showing us how to find ourselves, not just treating us like spoiled kids and giving us everything we want, but actually showing us how to do it and showing us the way where we can grow and find you. And please keep everyone safe this week, and thank you for everything, God. In Jesus' name, amen.